Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now, imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now, stop imagining and subscribe to the Planet Money podcast. Find Planet Money on iTunes, along with other NPR podcasts. And that's the music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we will lumber up from the ocean and take to the streets to battle giant insects and talk about Godzilla. From the monsters to the humans to the beeping of alarms and the red digital readouts. Then we'll consider the best trajectory of all as we visit with some pieces of culture that got better as they went along. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And other Thompson, Matt Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I direct Vertical Initiatives and Mischief.
Yeah, Matt is the guy at
NPR
whose job it is to know what verticals are.
Yes.
So you do Code Switch, which we know.
I run our race, ethnicity, and culture team, yes.
Our pals at Code Switch, and you're working on other verticals now.
Yes, we just today launched NPR Ed, NPR's new team covering learning and education.
Every time we add, like, a new editorial person, I generally kind of shake further down the hierarchy of intelligence in the building. So I go from being, like, the 432nd most intelligent person in the building to, like, the 438th with the addition of this team.
Yeah. Speaking of lowering your intelligence, no. I kid, sort of. So we went to see Godzilla, which, as you may know, Godzilla is a large monster with a long history in the movies. He originally was in a movie in the 50s. He has fought Mothra. Mm-hmm. He has fought, I don't know, Megalon and probably Dino Shark and whoever else. Godzilla was a sci-fi movie before there were sci-fi movies. Now, we're taping this on Monday. Godzilla has just this weekend, its opening weekend, made a honk ton of money, some of which came from us. Now, I'm going to start with our pal, Matt Thompson, who for some reason, now I don't know why we do this to people. With Chris Klimek, we bring him in for the punching movies. We seem to make Matt go to the big, loud Destructo movies very often. So
Matt has destroyed a few cities himself.
That's true.
That's actually true.
That's one of the vertical
part
initiatives.
Of my history.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Matt, you saw Godzilla.
I did see Godzilla.
Explain to me how your personal heart was affected by going to see Godzilla.
So I was struggling the entire time to come up with a good story to fill for the humans.
Yeah.
That was my aim for seeing Godzilla. I found Godzilla wonderful to look at and a really fun experience to look at overall. But the human parts of it, I did not so much cotton to. But I was coming up the entire time I was watching it with like alternate theories for what the human stories were and why they were there and why we kept on seeing like flashes of Godzilla's toenail and then extended periods of human non-drama. I came up with one theory. You want to hear it?
Absolutely.
Sure. So my theory, and this, I think it is impossible to have a spoiler that has anything to do with the humans because you basically know the entire human story the moment any of them appear on screen.
Right.
But my theory is that the protagonist of the movie, one Ford Brody.
We were talking before the show about the fact that the Ford Brody is the small, boxy, mini Jeep. So if you drive a Ford Brody, you're in the little truck.
Mm-hmm. My theory is that Ford Brody is himself a radioactive power source.
Uh-huh.
And that actually drives much of the action of the movie.
That would be fascinating. Maybe that will turn out to be true. I'm sure there will be sequels, considering how much money it made this weekend.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you say it was great to look at, you're talking about the monsters.
I mean, there's this one beautiful moment where there's a team of soldiers parachuting out of a helicopter through a fogged, darkened city with trails of red smoke pluming behind them as they fall.
Yep.
It's just this gorgeous visual image, and I think there's some like Bach playing underneath
it. It's actually the same music that Kubrick used in 2001 when you first see the monolith. When they're on the moon, they go to see the monolith. It's called Lux Aeterna. It's by Ligeti. And when I saw that, I was like, well, that is awfully upwardly mobile of you, Mr. Director Guy, evoking Kubrick. But then I thought, you know, 2001, ultimately, it's a movie about spaceships. It's a pretentious movie about spaceships, but it's a movie about spaceships. So, I gave it to him.
I would say just looking at the camera, looking at the movie, that the visuals of the movie did, I would say, touch my heart in some ways.
There were some
moments that were just delightful to look at, and it was clear that there was a lot of visual love and panache applied.
Okay, other Thompson. Stephen Thompson, my pal, what did you think of Godzilla?
Well, you mentioned, Matt, that you have the human scenes, which are kind of nothings, and the monster scenes, which are somethings. And on paper, I appreciate the fact that it's not just 2 hours of climaxes strung together. And a lot of big summer movies in the last few years, particularly, are just a string of bash, bash, building smashy, smashy, until you're just pulverized and it's over. So I kind of appreciate, in theory, how much time is spent on these boring nobodies I don't care about. And Godzilla is a particularly interesting action movie construct because Godzilla is rooted in post-nuclear annihilation Japan. And it's playing off of not only nuclear fears, but nuclear memories.
Mm-hmm.
It's full of very triggering imagery. All of the Godzilla movies are triggering imagery for the country of Japan. The director, Gareth Edwards, clearly made a conscious decision along the way. I'm going to throw in more modern and recent triggering images of destruction. And I was very distracted by this. You have scenes in which planes kind of fall out of the sky and hit buildings. There's a long, I found, very unpleasant tsunami sequence in which, again, it's like, as long as the Moppet is safe, the fact that thousands of people are horrifically, bloodlessly annihilated in this PG-13 movie is just supposed to be like, I mean, it's a disaster movie. So people are going to die in a disaster movie. I don't mean to sit here like, I think it's terrible.
But to pick up on your point, they are quoting the Fukushima nuclear disaster in a very overt, unambiguous way,
right,
which is what you were talking about, playing into those same very recent imagery.
Yeah, and I will say, I would actually make two disclaimers to my earlier statement that the human stories aren't all that affecting or interesting in Godzilla. One, there is one set of human stories. I actually found the Bryan Cranston, Juliette Binoche sequence pretty darn affecting. But the humans that the vast swaths of destruction that are visited upon cities, the humans whose lives are sort of regularly, unceremoniously ended all throughout the movie, and the visible path of destruction that's created, those stories, even though we don't see them as characters, those stories, there was a pretty palpable impact to that.
That's an interesting point. I think for me, when I go to see especially a big summer movie like this, like a big kind of tentpole movie, the reaction that I dread the most is just being completely and totally bored. And this was a movie where I was just completely and totally bored. I was so bored. And, you know, I was talking today with critic and friend of the show, Scott Tobias, who writes at The Dissolve. He was kind of saying, like, hey, now I'll give you that the first sort of two-thirds are slow. But then it's got that really incredibly satisfying and awesome last third. My problem is, the last third with the monsters fighting was the part where I was struggling to stay awake. But for me, I was saying this to Stephen today, the fact that they are big monsters and not kind of lithe, jumpy monsters means that the whole thing can be a little bit lumbering. And there has to be other stuff happening, or I just get this sense that I'm watching a slow motion action sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And there just was not enough going on for me in the movie to get me past the sense that I was just watching sort of the same thing over and over again. And I, believe me, I was up for this movie. I had heard some good reviews of this movie. I had heard some good reviews of it from people that I really respect. I am in no way not a cheap enough date for a Godzilla movie. Believe me. But I got there and I started to watch it. And first of all, it is real, like, do not let anybody fool you into thinking that Bryan Cranston is the lead of this movie. Yeah. Bryan Cranston is not the lead of this movie. The lead of this movie is Aaron Taylor Johnson, who plays the Ford Brody.
What can I do to get you into a fruit?
What do I do to get you into this Ford Brody? You know, and this character, who is the son of the character played by Bryan Cranston, is, for me, a very underwritten character. And then the actor, unfortunately, at least in this role, has really nothing to bring to it to elevate it. So when I was watching this and I was watching, his wife is played by Elizabeth Olsen, who is a real actress. Mm-hmm. And not to say he's not a real actor, but
She was in Martha, Marcia.
She was in Martha.
Marcia.
She was in Marcia. And she plays kind of this thankless, empty role of the wife who's crying and scared, and then at the end is running from the monster. I felt so, you know, at least if it's terrible, it's fun. And I didn't feel like it was terrible.
It's better than the Roland Emmerich.
I just didn't care.
All right, let me be the voice of the listener. You guys are all taking this way too seriously. You guys don't appreciate fun. You have no joy.
That is true.
You're thinking about it too much. I went into this. I was the one who didn't want to go see this, if you recall. I was like, really? Because I, growing up, was there are in the world giant robot people and giant monster people, and I was always a giant robot person.
Sure.
So give me a Space Giants, give me an Ultraman, give me a Voltron, give me a Johnny Sacco and his flying, and I am there because they defend us from the monsters. I never understood a Godzilla movie because, how is he? He's a monster. He's evil. I was sort of speciesist in this way. I was like, no, they're evil. Why would a monster be defending us? So I never had, and always looked dumb to me.
This is why he's in so much pain.
Exactly.
He's misunderstood.
This is exactly what I wanted from this movie. Yes, the first 20 minutes. I was not affected by the Julie Binoche, Bryan Cranston thing at all. I just like, come on.
I mean, the word Godzilla is not spoken until 45 minutes.
Absolutely. What I love is the feeling that the director of this movie has a vision. He is a person who knows how to manipulate us, and he does it in a way that we know we're being manipulated. I love the fact that so many of these scenes take place on some kind of bridge where humans feel the most vulnerable. I love that there's so many 1-2 punches in this thing where you see something happen, in this case a parachute coming down from a jet, and then like 5 seconds later the jet comes down. That is not the kind of aim it at a spectacle and let it go thing. There's a director there, a young director. I'm not going to compare it to Hitchcock, but he has that same sense of having fun with the audience. Yeah, I was sitting there wondering, why was I giggling when Godzilla does what I think is an atomic pile driver on one of these monsters? Why was I giggling when we see how Godzilla's face has so much more expression than, say, Ken Watanabe's face, who makes the one face. You take a great actor like Ken Watanabe and you just have him look vaguely constipated through the entire film. Mm-hmm. While, for the first time, Godzilla's expression, he snarls. He looks, and I'm going to ruin this movie for you because you will never be able to unsee it, he looks a lot like Michael Chiklis. There. Boom. You will never not see it. But I kept wondering, why am I giggling here when I hated how cynical I felt Man of Steel was and exploitative?
Right.
Why am I giggling here when I didn't like the end of Star Trek? It's because Superman saves people. That's what he does. Star Trek is about the tremendous potential of humanity working together. So it felt like seeing those movies, like they were misreading the text. This movie is reading the text at the top of its voice because these films are about stomping over a plywood Tokyo. That's exactly what this film is.
But see, and that was my thing about it. Like, I wanted a Godzilla movie that was fun and silly. I felt like this was a Godzilla movie that was humorless and heavy to me.
Oh, I didn't. I agree that it looked gorgeous. There are scenes from this thing that's just...
So much of it is in the dark, though. I'm not saying pretty things don't, you know, you can't shoot a pretty movie that takes place in the dark. Please don't send me that email. I'm just saying dark monsters on a dark background for like an hour and
knocking
a half.
Over dark buildings.
Knocking over darkened buildings.
They had blown the dark eggs.
In the dark. Kind of make me feel eventually like I'm just squinting the whole time. God.
But so much of it takes place in the desert where it's bright under bright sunlight. I just had a great time and you people are taking it too seriously.
And I think I would have been with you, Glenn, if Godzilla, who is, I mean, really the hero of this movie, had any more screen time and more of the movie were spent with him. A friend of mine, Drew Zebley, calculated that probably an hour and 10 minutes of the movie's running time was slow pre-reaction shots from humans about to anticipate something awful.
Yeah. Or something amazing. And I mean, there's been some of that complaining, like there's not enough Godzilla in this Godzilla movie. And it's been pointed out by several really intelligent critics that there's not a lot of the alien for a long time in Alien. You see very little of the shark in Jaws.
Yep.
To me, it wasn't like I need to see the monster more because he's the monster. It was I need to see the monster more because he's the interesting thing in the movie. And I read a really fascinating essay at the Dissolve today by David Ehrlich, who argues that the humans are boring on purpose because the movie's entire thesis is that we become unimportant.
Yeah.
And it essentially calls this the first post-humanity blockbuster. I really wanted to get on board with that because it's such an interesting idea.
Totally.
But I just kept going back to how I felt watching Ford Brody and his boring wife and their boring kid.
Yes.
And I just felt like
a movie about the indifference of nature to the fate of humankind is actually a really interesting movie. Well, and the 20 minutes of this movie that were about that, I thought were pretty compelling.
And if the movie really wants to be indifferent to humankind, it wouldn't set up these incredibly cynical scenes of Muppets being rescued.
Sure, sure.
I did not hate this movie. I agree with you, Glenn, that I liked this movie much better than Man of Steel, even though some of my complaints about it are similar to some of my complaints about Man of Steel. I was never fully able to engage with it. In part, I do have building smashy fatigue, absolutely. I did, as a side note, I saw this movie with my son. He looked at me and he said, I kept wanting to doze off because Godzilla's roar sounded like peaceful ocean noises.
Well, we know from the box office results that many of you have seen Godzilla. And so so you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you thought about Godzilla. And hopefully many of you see in the dark better than I do. That's all I'm going to say. So the other thing that we were going to talk about this week, you know, we hope that the show itself will be a good example of this very topic. But we wanted to talk a little bit about it. First, we were talking about reconsiderations, things that you've thought about again, which is a topic we've touched on in the past sometimes. Then we figured, you know, let's talk about things that actually got better, whether it's a piece that you like the ending better than the beginning or something that continues over time and you like the latter part better than the earlier part. We thought we would actually try to find some examples of culture that got better as it went along. I'm going to start with Glenn.
Okay. I would argue that Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has gotten better. It got better exactly at the point when you think it would, after it has to deal with the aftermath of Captain America 2, and something very momentous, the entire putative plot of the show changes. It started out not good. The problem with it was how generic it felt. I stayed with it for the first 10 or 12 episodes, and then I just dropped out because there was nothing individual about it. It felt like this is what Tuesday 8 o'clock television, network television, feels like to me. Very generic, very state. There's nothing in it to enliven it. And, you know, Joss Whedon gets some credit for his dialogue and also a lot of people slagging on it because they say everybody sounds the same, everybody has the same snarky dialogue. But I know he's doing it on purpose because he knows that when you are dealing with giant themes like he does, good versus evil, order versus chaos, freedom versus control, and you also deal, and I love the guy, but when you deal with the same kind of stock characters that he kind of brings in, the kick-ass lady, the quirky nerd, the block of wood with good arms, the worried mentor, you are really flattening these characters. You're really flattening these situations. What you need in that case is dialogue that feels individualized, that brings it out, that remembers that television is intimate, not just because it's in our homes, but because it lives in the two-shot. It lives in the moment of two people talking. That shot over the shoulder of somebody as they're talking, that's what television is, and that's what it does. That's why television is a writer's medium. You could take dialogue from a comic book or even from a movie screen, and it just wouldn't work in TV because it's too portentous. It's too broad. Things like, it's what I do, or I know there's good in you, all this kind of crappy dialogue is what the show had in spades. It dialed that back. I called it Marvel's Agents of JAG for Nerds because it had absolutely nothing going for it except for some actors that you like. Now, because it's done a major switch and because in the very last episode, there might be a casting decision that if they follow through with it at the next season with an actor I very much like that I don't want to spoil because it is kind of a surprise, it might be going in a really good direction. But the problem is these big, huge themes need to be deflated, and he does that very well. And the problem was for a long time that he's just executive producing the show. He's not going back over the scripts like he used to do for all his other shows and punching up the dialogue, punching it up, putting in jokes, doing whatever. He's giving it a pass, and you can kind of tell. So it's better. Is it good? Not yet. Might get there.
The thing that's interesting to me about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is that last summer when I was out at Press Tour, they showed the pilot of that show, which at the time was really one of the biggest buzzed about things of the fall. Mm-hmm. We were coming off of the Avengers and the Iron Man movies, and everybody was sort of very excited about what they were going to be able to do bringing this to television. It was so anticipated that there were, like, guards walking around among the TV critics, like, making sure nobody was recording it on their phone or something, I guess, which never happens, and nobody does, because nobody would care. Uh-huh. So it was such a hot property at that time, and so anticipated. And I felt like it arrived, and then it just kind of went funk. I saw the pilot. I didn't think it was any great shakes. I didn't think it was terrible, but I didn't think it was great, which is sort of what a lot of people thought.
Right.
And the thing that amazed me was not the, you know, there was some round condemnation of it as horrible, but just that it just kind of went away. Mm-hmm. It just seemed to sort of disappear into the ether and nobody cared.
The diss on it when it first came out is this is so far removed from the Marvel Universe that it doesn't feel like there's anything. We should see Spider-Man. We should see all these people.
Right.
Of course, I knew going in that it wouldn't have that. I knew that it would be off in this corner. I just desperately wanted there to be, to not have the writing kill puppies. I mean, the dialogue actually sits there and just lies there doing nothing except advancing the plot. That's changing, but it's still got a ways to go.
Yeah.
But I'm pulling for it now.
I think it's easier for television to improve than a lot of other art forms.
Yeah.
I think television, you have more natural storytelling momentum as you're working your way into a larger story and also learning from your mistakes, learning what works and doesn't work, and you're able to develop your character slowly. I think of all the media that we're probably going to talk about in this segment, television has, I think, the easiest time improving.
Well, they also can course correct. They can also hear the...
You don't make it all at the same time.
They don't make it all at the same time. It is an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Matt, what have you been thinking about in terms of things that got better?
So I've got two, and one of them is something that started great and has gotten super great. That's The Good Wife on CBS.
Oh, that sounds optimistic.
Yeah.
I agree.
So The Good Wife has been wonderful since its first season. True ensemble cast, and their guest actors and actresses are always delightful. But had its 100th episode in its fifth season, and the whole fifth season has been one of the creative peaks of the series. They just came back. They have fearlessly sort of flipped the show entirely in many ways, done a lot of things with the characters that I would not have expected, and it's been fantastic to watch. It's like the writers are just having a great amount of fun. The actors and actresses have gotten to explore aspects of their characters you might never have expected. It's been wonderful to watch.
With that show, I always want more law firm, less politics.
I
zone out of the politics. I mean, aside from watching Alan Cumming, which is always great, I could lop off the entire political, all the campaigning and all that stuff. And there was a little bit of a suggestion at the end of the season finale that we might be going into more politics. And I sort of thought, I don't know.
Yeah, I always tell people that The Good Wife is really three shows. It's a legal procedural, it's a family drama, and it's a political drama wrapped into one. The three affect each other, and they're all pretty well done. But I agree that the political drama has always been the least interesting of the three.
Yeah.
And actually, for most of the season, they sort of dialed back on it. I hope that they continue to do so.
Yeah.
My second nomination for this is another show, The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead, for me, is the television version of it has always been among the weakest versions of the franchise. You consider the television, the video game, the comic book.
Mm-hmm.
But the television series was the weakest one. And I think This past season was the first season that really felt to me like...
like you were hooking in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And part of it was that the protagonist, Rick Grimes, has always been... he's a tough character to love. And I think the actor does a capable job with him, but he's never been the character that has been my emotional hook to the series.
Yeah.
And this season, they spent much more time... in the previous season and in this season, they spent much more time developing the full ensemble. And in the interplay between characters, I found a lot more to appreciate.
Okay.
Yeah.
I agree, because the show's always been about the people and the lengths they'll go to survive, as opposed to the zombies. I would love it to be about the zombies and the zombies attack. There's a number of zombie attack. I would want it to be a video game, basically. That's kind of what I would want from it. But it really does vary from season to season. If you clock in to whatever dire straits they find themselves in, then you're in. I was in at the prison, was not in the farm. Oh, boy, the farm.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, seriously.
The farm.
The thing that zombie stories are often about is people struggling to retain their humanity in the face of this apocalyptic threat. They're rarely about the zombies. And in this one, the thing that The Walking Dead as a story has tried has to make the central moral drama of the show the effort of this main character of Rick Grimes to preserve some shred of humanity in his son Carl. And Carl is a pretty, on his face, unlikable character. That's never been that compelling a draw for the series. So the other cast members of the show trying to retain or demonstrate some humanity, like the character of Michonne, who started as a kind of gruff, almost walking stereotype, really deepened over the course of this season. It became a story about her demonstrating the aspects of herself that are human and interesting and compassionate. And that's been a much more interesting journey to watch than Rick's quest to save his son.
How about you, Stephen Thompson?
I took this almost entirely in a musical direction. We've talked in the past on this show about TV shows that have gotten slow starts and everything. And, you know, I had written down The Office, U.S., and Parks and Recreation, stuff like that. But I really started thinking almost obsessively about the weird trajectories that are imposed on musicians and on bands. The urge of not only critics but fans to kind of write the book on everybody from the first record is a very interesting notion that we never really apply to other art. There's a band from the mid-90s called Radish. They were supposed to be the next Nirvana, like many, many, many bands were. And the lead singer was a guy named Ben Queller, who is still a working singer-songwriter. He was 15 years old. And they got this big signing bonus. There was like a big article about them in the New Yorker that created a lot of resentment as that record was coming out. And it was fascinating to see Ben Queller, still a teenager, completely written off. For a long time, Ben Queller would put out solo records and people would be like, Radish, pooh. Like, he's a kid. But it's really interesting. There is a mindset, including among very smart people. I once had a fascinating conversation with Carrie Brownstein where she was saying, like, every band should just make one record. Now, she has not abided by that entirely in her own career. But she was like, that's where all the tension is. That's where all the things you have to say are. That's where all the combustibility is located. And everything after that is trying to recreate that combustibility.
Right.
And that's why so many bands are most interesting in their infancy.
This is also the argument people make for novelists. Your first novel is the one that is you.
Right. This is one of the things that I was going to say as well, is that as I start to think about things that got better, one of the things I think about is why is it so hard to find great examples of people where you say, oh, over the course of their career, they just got better and better and better and better. Because it's so much easier to find people where the sense is that it went the other way. You're M. Night Shyamalan. Why is it so unusual? And I thought of basically one of the same things that Carrie was saying about music and that Glenn is saying about books, which is having two really good ideas is twice as hard as having one really good idea. So you have to assume that a lot of people might only have one really amazing idea. And some people are able to continue to sort of work on that and do enough creative work. There are certainly people who have, great show after great show or great book after great book. or who peak much later in their career. But there's a different kind of person who has the one great idea, the one great tension, like Carrie was saying. You figure out, among other things, there's so many gatekeepers in music and in books and in other things that by the time you have put your first thing out and gotten through all those gatekeepers, you've had a million steps along the way to kind of perfect it. You know, it's not unusual for somebody's first sitcom to be something that they've been working on for 10 years. Your second one is not going to be something you've been working on for 10 years. Right. It's going to be, like Glenn said, that effort to recreate.
But, I mean, skills develop over a lifetime.
And, absolutely.
And voices develop. I mean, you also become wiser. That you have things to say about life later in life that you don't have when you're a kid. I'm curious, though, is that something that's a recent development of like, the pitchfork age? Was this always true? Stephen, or
largely it's always been true. You'd at least take it back to the dawn of rock and roll, you know, and kind of angry young men and women, and in the dawn of rock and roll, mostly men.
That there's that energy in your first.
Yeah, that there's that energy, and then your perspective changes.
Right.
If you are successful enough to make a second record and a third record and a fourth record, your life experiences are completely changed. The hungry young band in its garage of these plucky strivers singing about their hopes and dreams is different from, I gotta go make a record. You know, I gotta feed the cash cow because there's a lot's counting on me. And it's interesting. There's a band, not an obscure band, the band Everclear, put out like a small string of records in the 90s that I thought were exceptionally good. A record called Sparkle and Fade from 1995 is a fantastic record. It's all about the singer Art Alexakis battled terrible, terrible, terrible drug addiction and is singing about his very fresh rise out of that, and a lot of these very tense and immediate human struggles in those songs, and some of those songs are incredible. I don't want to be the bad guy. I don't want to do your sleepwalk dance anymore. I just want to see some palm trees. I will try and shake away this disease. We could live beside. God bless him. I'm so happy for him. He kicked it. And eventually, he was making these records where he had taken on this kind of like unctuous huckster routine where he's this like grinning goober. And
we do not mean to suggest that it is good for your art to be a drug addict.
Of course. But I mean, there were these very fresh and raw experiences. Again, like I would much rather the band make music that doesn't have that visceral appeal. But it is very hard to maintain the hunger and pain that fuels some of those early works once you are a very successful artist.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's another implicit in that is also, and to the gatekeeper effect that Linda mentioned before, once you create a success, all the pressure becomes replicating that success. You become pigeonholed into a certain sound, artistic identity.
Well, and you got to feed your team.
Yes.
You have responsibilities to your team.
There are a lot of artists who don't necessarily have one great idea. They have many great ideas, but they're only ever asked for the one. Artists that have managed to evolve. I mean, I think about someone like Fiona Apple, who continues releasing really stellar albums, I think. She started in one place. She started with an album that was very sort of sexy and moody. I've been a bad, bad girl. I've been careless with a delicate man. And it's a sad, sad world. When a girl will break a boy just because she can. And ended in another. Somewhere completely different, somewhere more esoteric. I'm a hot knife, I'm a hot knife, I'm a hot knife, he's a pat of butter. If I get a chance, I'm gonna show him that he's never gonna need another, never need another. If I'm butter, if I'm butter, if I'm butter, then he's a hot knife, he makes my heart. If I get a chance, I'm a mother, cause we show him never dancing, butter, never need another. And if you look at Fiona Apple's career, Fiona Apple has butted up against the system any number of times and managed through
the strength of the work to ultimately, eventually be able to put out the records that she wanted to make. A band that I would throw out there as a rare case of a band that got more interesting 20 years into its career is the Flaming Lips, where the Flaming Lips were a very ragged, weird, noisy, crazy, underground bunch of weirdos for years and years. And then they had the song She Don't Use Jelly. I'm talking a lot about 90s music today, which was a total novelty hit. And they were on Beverly Hills 90210. And then, like, 5 years later, they're putting out this record, The Soft Bulletin, where it's made up with, you know, 200 tracks, symphonic, amazing, gorgeous, glorious, beautiful sounds. And then in, like, I think it's 2001, 2002, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots is just this beautiful record. Do you? But they've spun off in all these weird directions where they can make different records every time. They can put out kind of crappy records or weird records. Their last record is called The Terror, and it is aptly named. You know, there are certain artists are able to carve out, like, the right to make whatever kinds of records they want because they're capable of making really interesting music 20, 30 years into their career.
I think that as we kind of get into this, what we're discovering is that a lot of what it makes you think about is kind of the entire idea of how you improve over the course of a career as an artist, like how you fight the things that make you the opposite of improve and how you do improve. And again, I would encourage everybody to come and find us and tell us what you think and tell us about your favorite improving artists and projects. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I have been looking for a big summer top-down rock and roll record in the spirit of one of my favorite records of the last few years, Celebration Rock by Japandroids, which is just an absolutely fantastic record. I haven't found it quite yet, but I have found a terrific rock band. I got this email out of the blue from my friend Dave DiOrio, who works at WCPN in Cleveland. He just emailed me an MP3 out of the blue and was like, please, 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 please check this out. It's by a band from Cleveland. He's repping his hometown. A band called Herzog. And we've played them on All Songs Considered before, and it never quite clicked with me. And this, when I heard this song called Full Stick, it's a minute and 40 seconds long, and that's how Dave hooked me. He's like, it's 100 seconds of your time. And I just thought immediately, I listened to it, and I'm like, I'm in a car. One thing I love about it is that the chorus is there's not actually like there's not a lyrical chorus. Yes. The chorus is just a jam.
You're looking for the word words.
thank you. It's not a wordsy chorus. Yeah. The album is called Boys. I've been starting to dig into it. It kicks off with that song. It spends a little bit of time trying to find that oomph again, but I have not tested it in my car yet. I'm really excited. The band is called Herzog. The album is called Boys. It's out this week. And give 100 seconds to that song, Full Stick.
Fabulous. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Gay of Thrones. This is a video series from Funny or Die. Comes out after the latest episode of Game of Thrones every week. Real-life hairstylist Jonathan Van Ness recaps the most recent episode of Game of Thrones for his clients, which include celebrities and near celebrities. And in this clip, this is the introduction to season 4, a little preview thing. And he's talking to a new hire at his salon, played by the very funny actor Jeffrey Self.
Are you excited for season 4? Game of Thrones?
I've never seen it.
Call Kerry Washington, girl. This is a scandal. If you are going to work at this salon, you've got to watch Game of Thrones. Don't worry, though. I'll catch you up. So, baby Kristen Stewart's family is dead, girl. Except for her Miss Cleo acting brother and her dumb sister. Baby Kristen Stewart is totally out for revenge, and I totally hope she gets it because she's out to shank all those that wronged her. And then, honey, there is Jon Snow, and she's making a sweat. It looks like Power Bottom King Joffrey is about to have to sashay away. But then his uncle daddy is all like, this war is not over. And who's
Now, there is a subset of the people listening who are like, yeah, that sounds fun. There's a subset of the people listening like, nope, not for me. That's what makes this world great. It's a video series, of course. So as he's saying something like, say, Blonde Cher, we see a clip of Cersei. As he's saying Mr. Sofia Vergara, we see Oberyn. As he's saying Stevie Nicks' Red Riding Hood, we see Melisandre. And as he's saying Christina Aguilera, we see Daenerys. It gets very discursive. And that particular clip ends with a big throwdown over who's better, Reese Witherspoon or Gwyneth Paltrow. It is not remotely safe for work, but it's a lot of fun. It's called Game of Thrones.
Wow. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Matt Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
I am happy about three things, one of which is a little bit self-promotional. It is, so today I have been waiting like a dozen years for a fantastic commencement speech database. Commencement speeches are little bursts of inspiration, can buoy you through a day or a week.
And like little TED Talks for the soul.
Little TED Talks for the soul. Go out and conquer the world, graduates. And we have released a database containing more than 300 of them going back to 1774. Kermit the Frog is in there, Wangari Maathai, Bill Cosby, you name it. Lots of folks. Check it out at npr.org/ed. I recently encountered a delightful little nugget of a short story by the writer and journalist Quinn Norton called Agency. It's a tiny little speculative fiction nugget, which I highly recommend to everyone. Just take 10 minutes out of your day and read this little short, and may it delight you as it did me. And lastly, with credit to our friends over at the Culture Gabfest at Slate, Miss Dana Stevens, she recently recommended a web series called High Maintenance, available on Vimeo, about the adventures of a pot dealer and his clients. And the series is fantastic. It's not just funny. It's also poignant. It makes the best use of the web series format in that each episode is exactly the length that it needs to be. All of the episodes are quite different tonally. They have a different cast of characters pretty much for everyone, and it's fantastic.
Excellent. Thank you, Matt Thompson. Making me happy this week, all of a sudden I am reading a bunch of books. Uh-huh. None of these books are done because I keep going from book to book to book because they're all really interesting and fascinating. I am reading Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. I am reading an advanced copy of Rainbow Rowell's Landline. I am reading another novel by a romance writer I have talked about on the show before, whose name is Julie James, and she has a new book out. I am reading like four other things at the same. Oh, I'm also reading The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, which has been recommended
great
on this
book.
Show by a couple of people. Mm-hmm. But as long as I have my Kindle with me wherever I go, I can just switch from book to book to book to book. So I'm reading a whole bunch of things right now. And that is the big thing that is making me happy right now, is all this this mad great reading. But in addition to that, making me happy this week, we have actual show news. You might remember when we had our live show in December, we sort of came out on social media and said, oh, we're having this live show and tickets are on sale. And then they were gone. And we wanted to make sure that if we ever again did a live show, that we gave you some notice, A, that we were going to do it, and B, that the tickets were going to go on sale, so that you would have the opportunity to think about whether you could go, think about whether you had friends who wanted to go with you.
Think about whether you still like us.
Think about whether you still like us. And so, as you might guess, what I am warming up to is that we are having another live show.
Yay.
We are having a live show on Tuesday, June 24th, the evening of Tuesday, June 24th, exact time, TBD. It will be here at NPR HQ in Washington, D.C. Tickets are going to go on sale on June 2nd, that's a Monday, at noon Eastern time. So think about it. Would you like to come to a live show? You know, we have a beautiful building. We have a live show. There will be lots of lovely, wonderful people there. We hope to have some terrific guests. Mm-hmm. Who knows? You never know who you might see. Last time around, we had Gene and Kat. We had Audie and Bob Boylan.
And my mother.
And Stephen's mother. And it was really quite wonderful. So we are sure that this one will be just as much fun. And again, 24th of June, Tuesday, 24th of June. Tickets will go on sale on June 2nd, and on that day, we will have a link at npr.org/PCHH that will tell you where to get tickets. So that will be, again, June 2nd, noon Eastern time, pop in, see if you can join us. We would love to see you. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Matt at M Tomps, M-T-H-O-M-P-S. And you can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And our also producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. And you can, of course, follow, as always, our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, as always.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now, imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now, stop imagining and subscribe to the Planet Money podcast. Find Planet Money on iTunes, along with other NPR podcasts.